Good morning, King's Chapel. It's good to be with you, even though it's not in person. This is a continuation of our sermon series in Esther, and we know with the ice storm last week, we wanted to continue in the progression and exegeting the passages as they came to us. And so as I am and my family on vacation in beautiful, warm Florida, I hope you guys are warm together at King's Chapel. I look forward to being back with you next Sunday and look forward to seeing all of your smiling faces and hearing a good report. I do just want to highlight that on Wednesday night we'll continue our adult discipleship class and we'll be covering the personal discipline of fasting. So if you are looking to come out, that will be this Wednesday. I'm excited about the personal discipline of fasting. I know it might not sound super fun, but it is going to be a good time together. So thankful for the opportunity to preach and continue in our series on Esther. So if you have your Bibles, I invite you to open them up to the passage that our deacon Gary Grace read for us from Esther chapter 2. A few weeks ago, I gave the warning, the encouragement on some of the subject matter that we're covering in Esther's ascension as the Queen of Persia. There are continued themes here that are dark. They're sinful. This is not a flippant story. It's real people. Real wickedness happened in this story. It is celebrated in the Persian Empire, and it affected Esther and her family. And I just wanted to, again, let you know that we won't ignore these topics, but we also don't want to treat them in a flippant way or go into more detail than the text goes into. And so even as I said last time, as a father of young children, the things that I'm going to say, I would be okay saying in front of them. They might have some questions, and we might have to explain it at their level, from all the way from 10 down to 4. But if you're a parent and you don't want your children to be exposed to these things, we totally understand. Or if you're saying, hey, I need help walking through some of this subject matter with them, the elders would be happy to do that with you and come alongside you for those conversations. This week there may be some more conversations that happen with some of the teenagers in the room or with parents. Please feel free to come and talk to us as elders if you need help. But secondly, I want to give another encouragement that if you feel yourself feeling shame or guilt or trapped in some sort of sin that's described here in our text, the elders want to come alongside and help you. The pastoral team, we want to not let you stay in that trap of sin, but we want to help move you along. So please feel free to reach out to any of us, and we will be happy to come alongside you for that journey. We all want to show honor and please those who we value in our lives. We can even become a little bit silly and foolish or blind when it comes to trying to please the people that we honor in our life. There's times when we work longer hours because we think it's going to help us in our career or put us in a better light. Or we buy certain clothes so that we can look a certain way and fit in with a particular crowd. We want to be invited to the party with the popular kids, so we try to act a certain way and be a certain way. How many of us have eaten a certain food or done an activity that we normally would not have done simply to be accepted into a certain friend group? Or think of this, when you began to date, you looked for ways that were special and unique to catch that person's attention. We want to please the people around us. Sometimes the irony is that many of us, when we try to be cool and individualistic, we just end up fitting in with a different type of crowd. The book of Proverbs takes pain to tell us that we should not go down the path that Lady Folly is on, and many on that crowd are seen as seductive and easy and extravagant and loud. And against that path, there's Lady Wisdom that points to life. Paul even tells us that bad company can corrupt bad morals, or good morals. They corrupt good morals. The desire to please someone, even authority that's over us, can lead to harmful choices or good choices. We ended in our text last time we were in Esther together with King Ahasuerus seeking to remedy his memories of his banished wife by authorizing a kingdom-wide search for the most beautiful women in his kingdom and bringing them into his harem, bringing them to his city, and putting them under the control of his chief eunuch, Haggai. They were to be given beauty treatments, and then the winner would be chosen, one who is more worthy or more pleasing to the king. You see that at the end of verse 4. The one who is more pleasing, the one who pleases the king, will be chosen queen. And it pleased the king. This debased and horrific sex contest, suggested by his attending young men, was aimed at simply playing to the base desires of this king. What our text today is going to show us is that these women go through the ritualistic cleansing, all in the name of pleasing the king. The women undergo their cleansing. They clean themselves with spices and perfumes, all for that opportunity to perform for one night with the hope of transforming their future to become queen. As we'll see, this type of self-cleaning is completely antithetical to the good news that is proclaimed in the gospel. The text that we look at today is going to move from the introduction of the Jewish family that we haven't even seen yet. We've been spent looking at King Ahasuerus and his kingdom and the pagan Persians. But now we're introduced to a Jewish family and their prosperity, which is shrouded in secrecy. We'll look at the hideous preparations of all these girls for the contest, and finally we'll see that a winner is crowned. The cleansing rituals and spices are aimed to please one man for one night, but as we will see, eternal acceptance with God, the King of all, is accomplished by Christ's work on the cross. If you have your Bibles, look at verses 5 through 7, where we look at first family matters. Family matters. There's a Jew in Susa the citadel, and his name's Mordecai. We're introduced to him, and in Scripture, we see lots of families that are introduced to us. There's family trees that are traced throughout the book of Numbers or the book of Chronicles. If you're doing your reading through the Bible in a year, sometimes those are the most difficult chapters to get through. They're tedious. There's lots of difficult names to read. But there's important themes and reminders in the family lines that are going to be important for us to have when we get in and through the book of Esther. We're introduced to Esther via her cousin Mordecai. And in the introducing of this family, Mordecai and Esther, there's important names that help us see the Lord's faithfulness and justice, even here in Susa. But also there's an introduction to Esther that tells us there's something that's coming. So first let's look at Mordecai. What's in this name Mordecai? When an author introduces Mordecai, he tells us that he's a Jew living in Susa. He's there in the city. He has close proximity to the king. If we recall, Susa is in modern-day Iran. It's about 900 miles away from the city of Jerusalem. So how did a Jew end up 900 miles away from his homeland? Well, the text tells us that this Jew, Mordecai, who's the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, had been carried away from Jerusalem. It wasn't his choice to be there. He had been carried away. This was part of the captivity. It was when King Jehoiakim, King Jeconiah was taken captive by King Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian exile. The Babylonian exile happened because the Israelites had continued to live in idolatry. And the Lord sent the Babylonians as punishment. And Mordecai was part of this deportation. Now, probably not Mordecai himself, but his family was part of that. If it was genuinely Mordecai, he would have been close to or even past the 100-year mark, but that doesn't really line up with what we see in the rest of the text. So it's probably his parents were taken away. One of the other things that we want to see here is that he's mentioned along with the king, and he's a Benjamite and all the Benjaminite and all of these different things. It means that he's probably a high-ranking official in the court in Israel. And now, just like we saw with Daniel and others, they look for high-ranking officials to put in other high-ranking officials in their city so that it's a little bit easier to rule. The other thing that we want to highlight here just for the moment is that he's from the tribe of Benjamin, and he's the son of Kish. There's significance for the rest of the story, but we're not going to get to it today. So I want you to remember, if you underline or highlight in your Bible, just highlight that, and we'll come back to it later. Mordecai is carried off. He's in a position close to the king. The name Mordecai is significant for understanding where the Jewish people are currently. You remember in the book of Daniel, when Daniel and his friends are taken captive, they're given new Babylonian names. It's a way of rebranding it, a way of renaming them, saying, you have been conquered by us, and now we're going to call you by our name. It's also a way to show which king or which god has conquered the other god. The name Daniel ends with the two letters L, which is the Hebrew word for God. So Daniel means, God is my judge. Mordecai is not given a Hebrew name. We don't know what his Hebrew name was or if he even had one. But it's interesting that the name Mordecai means man, or maybe even more specifically, worshiper of Marduk, a false god. Here's a Jew in a pagan land, and his name is a reminder that he is a man of Marduk. After his introduction to his lineage, we're told that this man of Marduk, Mordecai, this Jew who's living in exile away from his homeland, verse 7, he is bringing up Hadassah. That is Esther. Esther is the name of the goddess of love, Ishtar, close to that. Hadassah, though, is her Hebrew name, which is myrtle or flower. So there is this idea that commentators talk about that perhaps in Esther there's this battle of identity, Hadassah or Esther, and which one is going to win out. There could be that subtle hint that these Jews that are living in exile constantly have the struggle of, who am I away from Jerusalem? You know, at the end of the day, we have that struggle too. We have that struggle because, as Peter says, we're exiles in this world. When we come and gather together as the church, we might look a certain way, we might talk a certain way, but then we go home or we go to work or we go to school and we might look and talk in a little bit different. And there's a struggle of who am I? I go by the name Christian, but am I really Christ-like everywhere? That struggle isn't new. The Jews felt that while they were in Persia. Mordecai probably felt that. Esther probably felt that struggle as well, as they're around a culture that's pagan, and yet they're Jews serving the one true God. The good news is that God is faithful even in the midst of that struggle and perhaps even poor choices that we make. So these family matters, we see Mordecai and he's bringing up Esther. But as we look at verse 7, in the second half of verse 7, we see an ominous introduction to Esther. An ominous introduction here to Esther. What's highlighted twice for us is that she is an orphan. Twice we see that she has no father or mother. They'd passed away. I've broken the verse down for you so that you can see that. Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. And then at the end, and when her father and mother had died, Mordecai took her as his own. The Bible tells us that God cares for the orphans and for the widows. The author may be weaving into this story that this orphan girl that we're just becoming introduced to, Esther, God's going to take care of her, even though we don't know who she is, even though she's far away from Jerusalem, even though Mordecai might not be helping her as best as he knows how, God is going to care for her as an orphan. You know, James tells us that pure and undefiled religion is to look after the orphans and to visit the widows. It's a joy to partner with gospel partners like a JFO that takes care of orphans and widows. So thankful for Pastor Chris giving us the update on JFO even this morning. Pure religion is to look after the orphans. It's gospel-centered values to look out for those who are hurting. However, the way I've broken this verse down, it shows you that there's a bit of a chiasm here. A chiasm is just a fancy word for, it says the same thing at the beginning and at the end, and then there's something really important in the middle. So the two things that are reminded is that Esther is an orphan, but right in the middle is this ominous introduction. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. That's really important, and it's a little bit ominous. Why is it ominous for us? It's not ominous because being beautiful or pretty is bad, but it's ominous because of the introduction of the book of Esther. You remember back at the beginning that Vashti had a lovely figure and she was good to look at. And so now we're looking at Esther and we're going, uh-oh, this is exactly how Vashti was described. Is Esther going to be one of the young women taken and go to the king? Is she going to be the new queen? It's an ominous introduction because as you describe who this person is, that's going to propel what comes next. This is what Ahasuerus and the henchmen are looking for, beautiful figures, lovely to look at on the outside. It sets us up for what's going to happen in the rest of this passage. So when we move from the family introductions and the family matters, we move then into the prosperity of this family in secret. Prosperity in secret. You know, there's times when prosperity can come from who we are and what we do. And there's other times that prosperity happens even when we have something hiding in secret. Look at verses 8 and 9. The king's order to go collect these girls has gone out and is proclaimed. And it just says that many young women are gathered. It doesn't tell us how many. It says many. Even there in Susa, the city. And they were put under Haggai, just as the plan had mentioned. And Esther is one of those girls taken. Now, we have to mention that again, the way that these verbs are put in here, at the very beginning of our passage, verse 6, it says, these people had been carried away from Jerusalem. And just like the Israelites were taken away out of their homeland, so Esther is taken away. these exiles would have put up a long fight, but then after they were defeated, they would have just been chained up and walked away. Here, Esther is taken away. There's nothing mentioned that there was a fight. There's no mention that Mordecai tried to stop this. There was nothing about him trying to hide her. The verbs are meant not to justify her or to condemn her, but simply, this is what happened for many girls in Susa. The king's gathering, the edict's been out, and he's getting his way. There's no fight for these people. Again, the connection and points here with both Babylon and Daniel in winning favor happens. Look at verse 9. The young woman, that is Esther, pleased Haggai, and he won his favor. And Haggai quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food with the 7 chosen women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. It reminds us of Daniel, who goes to Babylon and he gets a portion of food and he gets promoted to the best places. But there's key differences. Remember, Daniel stands up and says, I can't eat this because I'm a Jew. And they put a contest and he's seen as this. But here, Esther doesn't put up a protest, but she still finds favor. Esther's provided and promoted not within the kingdom and ruling, but she's promoted within the harem, a place that no woman probably really wants to be promoted within. So the question is she just another pretty face? How did she get there? Do they care about her? She's an exiled Jew. Verses 10 and 11 tell us that even as she's being promoted, she's hiding who she really is. Verse 10 says that Esther had not made known her people or her kindred because Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. Don't tell them who you really are. That's why she's able to eat the food. We don't know. We want to read into it and say, maybe she did, like Daniel, tell them, no, I can only have vegetables or it has to be this way. But there's nothing in the text that tells us that. In fact, it kind of hints in the other direction that because she was hiding her Jewishness, she was able to participate. We're not told why Mordecai told Esther to keep her people hidden. Up to this point in the story, there's nothing necessarily anti-Jewish, although that's coming. And yes, you're right, that they are in exile, but there's nothing that explicitly says if you're a Jew, you can't be promoted. In fact, Mordecai, we'll see later, is sitting close to the king's palace. It may be that if she revealed that she was a Jew and a captive, that she wouldn't be promoted. She'd be demoted, and that would just mean less care for her in the harem. The Bible doesn't tell us. And we have to be careful not to read into the text too pure of motives or too sinister of motives for Mordecai. He simply may have been afraid and thought he might have been able to rescue her out of the harem once the contest ran its course and he could get her out. We may want to know all the closed door conversations that happened between Esther and Mordecai, but the Bible doesn't tell us, and so we need to be careful not to read more into it or to assume other things. All we know are that Mordecai said, "Don't tell them you're a Jew," and she obeyed him. Verse 11 tells us that he would check in on her every day. He would go down and like someone who raised a young child, wanted to know how she was doing. You know, as her advance in the kingdom or within the harem is happening and she's hiding her Jewishness, there are things that about her that she wouldn't have been able to participate in if she didn't, or if she did tell them that she was a Jew. One of the things would have been keeping the Sabbath. Another one would have been having sexual relations outside of the marriage covenant, and on top of that with a pagan. It would have been how she dressed and so on. But she advances. She advances. Again, I want to just paint the difference between Esther here and Daniel. Daniel goes in immediately and says, I can't eat this because I'm a Jew. Or when you think of the Babylonians, they get taken captive by the Persians. And Daniel's actually in the kingdom of Darius. And he prays every day, opening his window to Jerusalem. And they use his worship of Yahweh, the one true God, to actually get him and throw him into a lion's den. Now, I just mentioned that it was King Darius. And if you remember who King Darius is to King Ahasuerus, that's his dad. So perhaps that's a reason, again, we're not told, but maybe that's a reason why Mordecai doesn't want Esther to say, you're a Jew, because maybe that lion pit is still quite active. We don't know. Whatever the case, their heritage is covered up. Mordecai is an official, and he's asking how she's doing. Now, in being careful not to read into Scripture what we want to be there, we also need to make sure that these exiles are not seen as horrible people. These are two exiles trying to make their way through a pagan culture as those who are Jews. I love how one commentator puts it. They write, regardless of their character, that is Mordecai and Esther, regardless of their motives or their fidelity to God's law, the decisions Esther and Mordecai make move events in some inscrutable way to fulfill the covenant promises God made to his people long ago. All of that means is God is sovereign even over those difficult decisions that we're not sure, should I go left or should I go right? God is moving all things towards his end and his glory. And this text helps us see that. God's sovereignty is over all choices, even those that may be dubious at best. So here's Esther. She's prospering even though she's keeping a secret. She's moving up in this harem and this contest, this awful contest that Ahasuerus has put into motion, gets explained a little bit more with hideous preparations. Verses 12 through 14 help us understand what this contest looked like and what was happening. It explains for us what life was like for Esther during this time. Says this, now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, it was a year in preparation. So they would have been in this harem for an entire year under the regulations for the women. Since this was the regular period of beautifying, 6 months of oil, 6 months of spices and ointments. Then the young woman would go in one night and she would be transferred into another concubine's chamber, and she wouldn't go back unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. For an entire year, all that these girls would do would prepare for that one night with Ahasuerus. It was an intensive, all-inclusive preparation. This is reference to the cosmetics that were talked about earlier in the chapter when the young men were saying, let the cosmetics be given to these young girls so that they can be prepared for you. They're pampered and prepared for this one night. Just like King Ahasuerus didn't spare any expense for the party while showing off his wealth, so he also is not going to spare any expense for these young girls who are coming to please him. So for an entire year, these expensive beauty treatments are given to them. They're the best the world has to offer. There would have been lotions and perfumes and luxury for these women. And Esther, being promoted, would have had the top of the top. But unfortunately, these are hideous preparations. There's two illustrations that we might need to think about for just a moment. One of them we talked about a little bit with the story of Joseph, where it's just like wheat being gathered in to the barn. Or a second one would have been with this idea of spices and ointments, the way that you would prepare meat for a party. You spice it up. But not only is that absolutely grotesque, but these girls are being prepared in a very real sense to be sacrificed to the king. It is as if he is the God and they are the sacrifice. It's a one-time sacrifice, so we get them all ready for this one night, and it's all for your pleasure. The rituals and the ceremonies that they go through to be prepared for that one time, to be an acceptable sacrifice, to be pleasing to the king, as if a sacrifice is to be pleasing to a God. The Bible describes this, and it's just for the one night for the king. It says this in verse 13, that she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace for her one night. Commentators aren't agreed on what that might have been. It could have simply been a wardrobe, what she wore, or jewelry and gold and rings. And she would have been able to keep those things as her payment for that one night. Or it might have been something more sinister. And after that one night, she would have been moved over into the used category. You see that they would have been moved into the second harem, into this other place with Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who had charge of the concubines. She's no longer in the special harem waiting for her one night. Now she's over here in the used bin. And she doesn't even have a one night potential coming unless the king remembers her and calls for her by name. Discarded. Used. Unfortunately, if one of these young women would have been impregnated, they would have had this child, but there would have been no opportunity for them to be an heir to the throne. But they would have been raised in the palace. What the text is highlighting for us, as awful as it is, as hideous as it is that this King Xerxes, this King Ahasuerus, everything revolves around him. He rules 127 provinces. He's got all the princes. He can make his word law. And now all the girls are being brought to him as if they are being sacrificed to him as God. He acts as if he is the God. And they are the people coming to sacrifice to his whims and his desires. It's awful. These types of preparations should cause a visceral and have a distinct distaste in our own hearts, our minds, and our stomachs. It's awful that these young women would be treated in such a horrible and crass way. As if their only value is to be beautiful for this very self-centered man. Unfortunately, in our own world today, there are young girls who are raised to believe the same thing is true of them. That their only value is what is on the outside and how they look. that their only value is how some man in power may look at them. It's seen in our movies, the magazines, social media, friends, at parties, and everywhere else in the world. Our young women are told, this is what is beautiful. Be this way. Find your identity there. It's at this point that I want to just interject for just a few moments the wonder of the beauty of the gospel. Because the gospel tells us that men and women are created equal in God's image. Proverbs 31:30 tells specifically women from a husband's point of view that charm is deceitful and beauty is fading. It doesn't last. He says that to his wife, who's the most beautiful to him. But it's not because of her external beauty. It's because of her internal beauty. And Peter says this, that the unfading beauty that Christian women have is of a gentle and quiet spirit. That is the beauty of the gospel. It's unfading. It doesn't stop. Pursue inner beauty as Jesus transforms you into a woman of unfading beauty with a gentle and quiet spirit. So thankful for all of our deaconesses and our elders' wives who picture this beautifully. Friends, there's beauty that this world tells us you ought to pursue. It's deceitful. But if we can look at the flip side, brothers in Christ, is what we value and say is beautiful, is that quiet and gentle spirit? Or is it something physical and external? What do we pursue and what do we model for our daughters, for our sisters, for those around us? Pursue gospel beauty in the inner person. The whole purpose of this debased contest that King Ahasuerus has put into place is to find a new queen. And so in verses 15 through 18, we see that there is indeed a winner crowned. In any competition, there's only one who gets the crown. There's only one person who gets the winner's trophy, if you will. The text doesn't tell us how long the contest went on. We don't know if Esther was the very last one to go in, or if she was the very first one, or if she was somewhere in between. We don't know. All we know is that in verse 15 it says, when the turn came for Esther, she goes in. Esther's turn. And here's how she handles the situation. She asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, told her to take in. She looked for advice. What should I take in? What's going to please the king, Haggai? And she listens to the advice of Haggai. And she does it. We don't know what it was that she took in, but we know that she took the recommendation of Haggai. At this point in the story, for King Xerxes, for King Ahasuerus, he's taken advice, and it's always turned out very poorly, morally, and for himself. And so here is Esther taking now a pagan eunuch's advice, and we have to ask ourselves, how is this going to turn out for Esther? Is this going to go well or not well for her? We can only imagine what's going to happen to her. Again, at this point in our story, if you look at the end of verse 15, it says, now Esther was winning the favor in the eyes of all who saw her. She's again being promoted. She's moving up. And she goes in, and it gives us the time of this, several years after the beginning of the story happens. Again, I want to remind us at this point in the story that we often want to place our intentions, how we might be feeling if we were in this situation, or how awful we would be feeling if this was our daughter or sister or cousin, and the twistedness in our own stomachs. And we want to feel that. And it's just, man, Esther had no other choice. She couldn't have done anything different. But the text doesn't tell us that. The text doesn't tell us that she went in begrudgingly. The text doesn't tell us that she went in with pure motives. It doesn't say, well, I'm just going to do this with my eyes closed, sort of a thing. There's nothing in the text that tells us that. And so we need to be careful not to read that into the text, as difficult as that might be for us to stomach. She goes in and she's been winning favor with Haggai within the harem and with everyone else who saw her. So it really shouldn't surprise us that in verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. She wins. She wins. Just like Joseph or Nehemiah or Daniel, others who were in exile or captivity, Esther wins favor. But it almost might be ironic because now she's married to a pagan king. She's loved more than all the women. This isn't a nice, good, pure, upstanding love, but rather, no, this is exactly what he's been looking for, a beautiful figure, one who pleased him. Again, there's a feast that is thrown, verse 18. The king gave a great feast for all of his officials and servants, and it's Esther's feast. It's a great feast. This again harkens back to the eating. Again, we've been comparing and contrasting Daniel with this, and here is Esther again at a feast of pagans at the head with her husband. He loves Queen Esther so much that he grants remission on taxes and he gives gifts. The kingdom has a new queen. Esther is neither condemned nor commended for us in the text. Simply that she is going through these things. We don't know. We don't know if she's happily indulging in the wonderful place that she now has, or if she is ripped apart inside. One commentator says this: the author of Esther is skillfully describing a morally ambiguous and complex situation because that's the way real life often is in a fallen world. It's not cut and dry. It's not easy. The encouragement is that when every choice around us might feel wrong, or it might be mostly right, but there's a little bit of wrong in there, or maybe there was a little bit of bad, God is still sovereignly working in and through those times, even from a pagan king who has given an awful, awful edict. I love the way another author writes about this. They write, quote, Esther may have looked back on this episode of her life with shame and regret, or she may have looked back on it with a clear conscience, knowing that she acted as wisely as she knew how at the time. In either case, every one of us also has both kinds of episodes in our own lives. Esther's story shows that we can entrust all of our decisions to the Lord and move forward. In other words, if Esther looked back and said, I should have handled things differently, she could have handed that guilt to the Lord and moved forward. Or if she looked back and said, I acted as wisely as I possibly could have, and there was nothing different that I knew how to do at the time, she could move forward with the Lord as her strength. The application for you and for me from Esther is this. Maybe you've made some poor choices in your life, or a series of poor choices, or a lifetime of bad choices. You've walked down the wrong path. The gospel of Jesus Christ calls you to turn and come to Him and find full and total forgiveness in Jesus Christ at the cross. Or if you're following the Lord and you're making wise choices through difficult things in your life, then continue to trust the Lord and follow Him, and He will guide and guard you. Now we turn to King Ahasuerus in this story. And before, again, we go too far and we judge this king for doing these awful, terrible things, we need to identify with how we may be acting quite like him. First, our world is very sexualized. And there are times and places where we curate our lives to get what we want, when we want, how we want, through our entertainment, through our diets, through all of these things. We may not be able to afford a year-long kingdom-wide contest for ourselves, but we curate our scrolls and our movies and our books to gain the satisfaction that we want. Or secondly, it's not only in the area of sex that we might tend to be like Ahasuerus, but we tend to maybe make people clean themselves up and get their act together before they can come before us. We put in the requirements and the rituals, and we place people around us to help make sure that they're clean before they can come and talk to us. And this is where the gospel of Jesus Christ tells us a different story that is wonderfully and totally antithetical to what the world, what Ahasuerus, and what our own hearts lean towards. See, the gospel calls us to God. But the gospel doesn't say, go out and clean yourselves up for an entire year. Get your act together before you can come before God. It doesn't say, give your best for an entire year, and then you can come in for one night and give it your best shot, and we'll see if you're acceptable and pleasing to God. The gospel doesn't say, come home after wallowing in the mud and clean yourself up, and we'll see if you're really repentant this time. No, the gospel of Jesus Christ says, turn to Jesus, who took all of your sin, who took all of the shame, who took all of the guilt, and died in your place, and now clothes you in perfect righteousness, which is exactly the way you are pleasing to God. And here's the wonderfully good and beautiful news. It's not just for one night. It's for eternity. God's work at the cross in Jesus Christ satisfies Him forever. It's not just one night. Jesus says, I know you're dirty. I know you're broken. I know you failed. I know you're despised. And I've taken that all on myself. I've become the sacrifice so that you can be spotless and blameless and perfect forever, not just for one night. You are always acceptable in God's sight when you're in Jesus Christ in His righteousness. You and I can't clean ourselves up to come before God because Jesus has already done that. You think of Jesus when He's talking to Peter, and Peter's like, I need all of me washed. He says, that's not the point, Peter. Just wash your feet off. You're acceptable to me. There's no probationary time. There's no second class Christians. There's no second category for those who are used or broken. In the gospel of Jesus Christ, you are clean and you are acceptable and you are pleasing to God in His sight. In fact, that's what Paul says to the Corinthians. that you are an aroma to God in the gospel, and it's a good aroma to those who are being saved, and to those who are perishing, it's a stink. The gospel tells us that we don't have to work to clean ourselves to be acceptable before the King of the universe. And it's not just for one night, it's for eternity. What good news. So you can stop working. You can stop shaming yourself. You can stop sitting in the guilt. You don't have to clean up the worst parts of you to come to Jesus. He knows about them. You confess them, repent from them, and turn to Him in faith, and you will be clean forever. Four quick final gospel observations, and the band can come forward at this time. First and foremost, friends, God is working even when we don't see it, even when we don't feel it, even when those around us are sinning, even when there are horrible decisions made by wicked kings, God is working His will. Even when we feel like we have no other choice but to make bad choices or not as great choices as we would want to, God is working. Secondly, God is working in those unseemly situations. Just as I stated, even when there are things that are happening that we would say, I don't see how God could be working through this. How could God work through something as crass as a sex contest? And He does for His glory. Third, the gospel goes out. Jesus cleanses us completely and totally. And that's what makes us pleasing to God for eternity. It's not your good works. It's not my good works. It's not how sincere we are. It's not how great we are. It's not how much money we give. It's not how many prayers we say. Jesus is the one who cleanses us. He makes us clean. And He doesn't make us clean for one night. He makes us clean for eternity. And fourth and lastly, because Jesus is the one who cleans us, the gospel goes out to those who are broken and outcast. It doesn't just go out to the beautiful women. It goes out to those who are broken because Jesus cleanses and Jesus heals and Jesus does a perfect work for all eternity. Brothers and sisters, may God bless you as you meditate on the goodness of Jesus Christ as He cleanses us from all unrighteousness. We'll see you soon.